The Supreme Court sides with Donald Trump.
The outcome will further delay a special counsel's case against Trump, who is alleged to have tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election.
The far right topples centrists in French elections.
The results were in line with opinion polls ahead of the election, but provided little clarity on whether Le Pen's anti-immigrant, Eurosceptic party will be able to form a government and coexist with pro-EU Macron after next Sunday's second round of voting is concluded.
And later, Hungary takes over the EU presidency. We'll get an update from Kyiv, and can World War III be prevented? Today is Monday, July 1st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. In an important and historical decision, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that former U.S. presidents have limited immunity from prosecution. Steve Herman, VOA's chief national correspondent, has the details from Washington.
In a 6-3 decision split along ideological lines, the justices on the United States Supreme Court sent back to a lower court the criminal case against former President Donald Trump, in which he is charged with plotting to overthrow the presidential election 4 years ago. The majority of the court declared former presidents have absolute immunity from prosecution for their official acts. However, they do not have immunity from what are deemed unofficial acts. The outcome will further delay a special counsel's case against Trump, who is alleged to have tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election after he lost to Joe Biden. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Turning our attention to the Middle East, the United States continues pushing for an Israel-Hamas peace plan. Meanwhile, both Israel and Hamas say there's been no progress as fighting continues. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Israeli tanks take position at the border with Gaza early Sunday morning as plumes of smoke rise from the ashes of another military strike. Just one day earlier, in the central Gaza Strip, Israeli airstrikes killed at least three Palestinians, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. An Associated Press reporter on site confirmed seeing three dead bodies. That puts the ministry's official death toll north of 37,800 Palestinians since Israel launched its all-out offensive following the October 7 attacks. It was then that Hamas and its allies stormed into Israel, killing 1,200 mostly civilians and kidnapping some 250 others. Israel since vowed the eradication of Hamas at all costs and the return of hostages taken that day. At a cabinet meeting Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu explained what he called the sacred task of freeing hostages, as well as delays to a peace deal.
Everyone knows the simple truth. Hamas is the only obstacle to the release of our hostages. With the combination of political pressure and military pressure, above all, military pressure, we will return them all 120 of our hostages, the living and the dead.
But for many Israelis, that's simply not enough, as thousands again gathered in Tel Aviv demanding elections to remove Netanyahu amid calls for greater action to return hostages taken on October 7th. The United States, along with regional partners, has been working to broker a peace deal between Israel and Hamas, but it seems both sides remain entrenched, as Hamas demands a total ceasefire and Israel's complete withdrawal from Gaza, while Israel agrees only to temporary pauses until Hamas is no more. Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan at a news conference in Beirut.
There's been no real progress at the end of aggression negotiations. Once again, Hamas is ready to deal positively with any proposal that secures a permanent ceasefire, a comprehensive withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and a serious swap deal.
The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says the war displaced most of Gaza's 2.3 million residents, many now living in tent cities as temperatures soar above 32 degrees Celsius. The United States, for its part, remains Israel's staunchest ally in material and financial support, but calls for a ceasefire grow by the day with images pouring in of the civilian toll of the war. As of Friday, the United Nations said at least 60,000 people had been forced to flee areas in the east and northeast of Gaza City. The U.S. ambassador to Egypt, Hera Mustafa Garg, visited aid storage facilities in North Sinai and the Rafah border crossing amid the latest calls for peace. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
On Monday, Hungary's nationalist government, which has a history of blocking or denying funds and arms for Ukraine and maintaining strong ties with Moscow, takes its turn in the rotation as president of the European Union. All this as Russian missile attacks continued across Ukrainian cities over the weekend. VOA's Lori London gets the details from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
To be honest, every weekend in Ukraine is something that people are expecting new shelling coming, and usually this is what happened. And this weekend as well, it was quite a heavy shelling of the city of Kharkiv once again. And unfortunately, the city of Kharkiv is constantly under attack, but this particular one took life of one person and at least 10 people were injured. And also one newborn child was also injured as a result of this attack. Again, the residential areas were under attack mostly, and also one of the post office centers where the packages are basically taking pass to other regions from Kharkiv, including those regions which are closer to the front line. Also, not just Kharkiv, but also the central part of Ukraine was under attack. The city of Kropivnitsky, which is in the central part, was under missile attack. At this point, we don't have confirmed information about the main target, but it could be that in that area, the military target was the main goal for the Russian forces this time. And also the city of Kyiv was under attack by two Iskander missiles. Both missiles were destroyed in the air, but debris fall caused damages of the residential building, and a couple of apartments were actually went on fire and were almost completely destroyed. A lot of people had shock and stress reaction that caused them the hospital trip. Basically, people were taken to the hospital due to the mainly stress.
The EU presidency rotates among its member countries, and Hungary is taking over the helm of the European Union as of July 1st. Now, given its strong ties with Russia, and Viktor Orban in recent years has routinely gone against the grain, so to speak, of most other leaders on issues like the war in Ukraine and relations with Russia and China. Have you heard anything about how Kyiv or Ukrainians are feeling about Hungary taking the helm of the European Union?
Yeah, well, actually, Ukraine and Hungary have quite a complicated relationship. And at the recent EU summit that President Zelensky attended, it was a very quick conversation between Mr. Orban and Mr. Zelensky. It looked at least quite an emotional conversation, but it seems that both sides agreed on something, and at least it was a dialogue between them. And after that, there were rumors going around inside of Ukraine that it might be that President of Ukraine and Mr. Orban are up for a meeting. It could be in Ukraine or not. We don't have any details, but it looks like that certain dialogue is ongoing, and at least on the diplomatic level, Ukraine and Hungary do have meetings of the ministers of foreign affairs and do have certain discussions, and Hungary even proposed 11-step agreement or 11-step plan for Ukraine and Hungary relations to proceed and to improve. For Ukraine to implement. There are some lines in that plan which Ukraine do not support. However, we might see certain change in the rhetorics. We might see certain change in the relations between Ukraine and Hungary. Here in Ukraine, there is the main hope and the main belief is that still doesn't matter what Mr. Orban is saying and how he is reacting to certain things, especially in connection to Ukraine and aid to Ukraine, but he is still the member of the EU and NATO, and he will still have to follow the overall movement and the overall decisions by most of the member states. So there is probably the main belief.
Lori London is the host of Flashpoint Ukraine. Here on The Voice of America, she was speaking with our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova. Elsewhere in Europe, in France, exit polls show Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party winning about 34% of the vote in the first round of parliamentary elections on Sunday. Reuters' Chris Dignam has more.
Exit polls showed that Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party won the first round of parliamentary elections in France on Sunday, but the final result will depend on days of hard bargaining before the second round of voting next week. Sunday's outcome is a major blow to President Emmanuel Macron, who stunned the nation when he called for snap elections after his party was trounced by the National Rally Party in European Parliament elections earlier this month. In a speech to supporters Sunday night, Le Pen said her party's victory was decisive.
My dear compatriots, democracy has spoken, and the French people have placed the National Rally and its allies on top, and have practically wiped out President Macron's party.
Le Bloc Macroniste.
The results were in line with opinion polls ahead of the election, but provided little clarity on whether Le Pen's anti-immigrant, Eurosceptic party will be able to form a government and coexist with pro-EU Macron after next Sunday's second round of voting is concluded. A week of tough political decisions now lies ahead. In the past, center-right and center-left parties have teamed up to keep the National Rally from power, but that dynamic is less certain than ever. A longtime pariah, the far-right National Rally is now closer to power than it has ever been. Le Pen has sought to clean up the image of her party. Known for racism and anti-Semitism, her efforts appear to have worked amid voter anger at Macron, the high cost of living, and growing concerns over immigration.
That's Chris Dignam of Reuters reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at the possibility of World War III in a moment, but first, another election story. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are back on the campaign trail following their first debate last week. Biden's poor performance in that debate has some members of his political party looking at who might replace him as their nominee. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden were back on the campaign trail after last week's first debate, with Biden looking to reassure supporters that he's ready for a second term following an at times halting debate performance.
I give you my word as a Biden, I would not be running again if I didn't believe with all my heart and soul I can do this job, because quite frankly, the stakes are too high.
Biden fundraising over the weekend was another chance for his campaign to push back against concern among some in the Democratic Party that his debate stumbles mean they should be looking for a new candidate. University of Virginia Center for Politics director Larry Sabato.
If there were a new, vigorous, younger Democratic nominee, I think people would take that opportunity in a minute to keep Trump out.
Trump said the debate showed this election is a choice between strength and weakness.
The question every voter should be asking themselves today is not whether Joe Biden can survive a 90-minute debate performance, but whether America can survive four more years of crooked Joe Biden in the White House.
Trump told a post-debate rally that he believes Biden will stay in the race.
Many people are saying that after last night's performance that Joe Biden is leaving the race. But the fact is, I don't really believe that because he does better in polls than any of the Democrats they're talking about.
Among the Democrats who some in their party are talking about possibly replacing Biden are his running mate, Vice President Kamala Harris, Governor of the key swing state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. None of those Democrats is calling for replacing Biden. Switching candidates before their party's August convention would require Biden dropping out. Again, Larry Sabato.
They would have to go to the White House and try to convince him, and he will be tough to convince. And they'll also have to try to convince Joe Biden, and that may be even tougher.
The First Lady told a post-debate rally that her husband showed he's America's best choice.
What you saw last night on the debate stage was Joe Biden, a president with integrity and character, who told the truth. And Donald Trump told lie after lie after lie.
Early post-debate polling by CBS News shows most Democrats believe Biden should still be their nominee. It's the political party's conventions that will have greater impacts with voters than debates, says Marquette University political science professor Julia Azari.
The sort of state-of-the-art research in political science about what sorts of events seem to drive vote intent and become increasingly sort of predictive of how people will vote in November. The conventions matter, but debates don't.
The Biden campaign held a post-debate conference call with Democratic National Committee members about the coming convention. Some committee members on the call told the Associated Press that it was an overly rosy assessment of Biden's path to re-election and largely ignored criticism of his debate performance. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
As conflicts with global consequences are taking place in Ukraine, Israel, and the South China Sea, among others, many pundits warn that a new world war is possible if world leaders don't take measures to end the hostilities before things get out of control. But have we already passed that point? My guest is British historian Richard Overy. His latest article for The Telegraph is called Why It's Too Late to Stop World War III.
Well, I have to say that the title was chosen by the newspaper, not by me. I think really what they wanted me to say, and what I think I've been saying, is that war is so embedded in the way in which we conduct human affairs, and this goes back, of course, tens of thousands of years, that it's very easy to imagine that World War III will break out as a result of a mix of different tensions. We don't know which tension is going to be decisive. And I hope it doesn't break out, of course. But it's extraordinary, with all the history lessons we have, that world leaders seem incapable of learning from them. They talk up crisis, and as a result, you get a crisis.
Is there any specific history lesson you're thinking of that world leaders should have learned from that they're not?
Well, the best one is the outbreak of the First World War, and nobody expected it to happen. It's a question of misjudgment, mistrust. Each of the powers are worried about their own security, and so they got dragged into a general conflict from what started out as a very specific conflict between Austria and Serbia, a bit like the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And that's an ideal model in some ways of a world war, a catastrophic world war that emerged from a whole series of misjudgments and failed understanding.
So what's your take on world leaders today? Are they ignorant of this history? Do they not care? Are they being selfish?
I think they are broadly ignorant. I think that statesmen in any decade are basically governed by what's going on around them, by the circumstances they confront and the challenges they feel personally themselves. The exception to that is President Putin. And President Putin, of course, is very aware of history, but he's distorted the past. He uses it to argue that there's no such place as Ukraine, for example. He uses it to blame the Western powers for, Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union and so on and so on. He's very aware of history, but he doesn't seem very aware of the dangers that his actions run in terms of prompting others to react in terms of their own security. In many ways, he is the most dangerous of all the figures that we're facing.
So the old expression is, those that don't study history are doomed to repeat it. You've studied more history than most anybody. Is there a historical lesson that we can learn from to avoid World War III? Is this inevitable?
It's not inevitable, no, and I didn't really mean that to argue that in the newspaper article. I think that the obvious lesson is that you don't keep talking up war when you reach a moment of crisis. It's much more important to talk up compromise, discussion, possibility of reaching agreement, and so on, rather than reaching rhetorically for the first tool, which is, this is getting dangerous, you've got to watch out, Putin's threats of nuclear war, and so on and so on. I mean, none of this is helpful. What you need is a broader commitment to the idea that these are issues that can in the end be resolved.
And is there a specific historical lesson we can look back to where this worked?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, there aren't many. I mean, the long 19th century, which is a long period of relative peace between the European states following the Napoleonic War, depended very much on Britain as the hegemonic power. And Britain was always interested in peace discussion rather than simply reaching for or reaching for a gun. I mean, that's probably the best example that one can think of. In the modern age, since the beginning of the last century, it's been extremely difficult. I mean, even in cases where agreement seems to have been reached, clearly we all wish it wasn't like that. Clearly we all wish there isn't a risk of World War III. But as long as people keep talking about it, talking it out, preparing themselves, that's the most dangerous thing.
That's historian Richard Overy. He's a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. His latest book is called Why War? Torrential rain in several cities across India have caused severe flooding. In the northern city of Moradabad, boats moved slowly past partially submerged houses. Julie is a resident of Moradabad. She says she is now getting around by boat after being unable to go anywhere and feeling helpless for 2 days. Flooding is also reported in Gujarat on India's west coast and in New Delhi, where 11 people were killed because of the rain and resulting floods. There's deadly rain in Europe as well. 4 people have died and 2 are missing in Switzerland after violent thunderstorms and melting snow caused flooding and landslides there. Beryl is now a Category 4 hurricane. It steamed across the Atlantic Ocean on Sunday afternoon towards the Caribbean's Windward Islands, where it's expected to bring life-threatening winds and flash flooding on Monday. Reuters' Saikir Jasni has that report.
The Eastern Caribbean was bracing for the unusually early Category 4 Hurricane Beryl as it raced toward them Sunday. Shops in St. Vincent were boarded up, while residents packed petrol stations to fill up their cars. While 100 miles to the east in Barbados, shoppers were rushing to stock up at this supermarket in Bridgetown. Beryl has already made history as the earliest Category 4 hurricane on record, and it's expected to bring life-threatening winds and flash floods to the island on Monday. Justina is a manager at a hardware store in Bridgetown.
We opened about half an hour earlier this morning to accommodate the rush. And they have been buying generators, five pound buckets, everything you can think about they're getting. We're almost out of, you can see searchlights, extension cords, ladders, tape, whatever they can get their hands on, they're getting.
The U.S. National Hurricane Center says the hurricane was located about 250 miles southeast of Barbados on Sunday afternoon with winds of 130 miles per hour. It is rare for a major hurricane to appear this early in the Atlantic hurricane season, which runs from the start of June to the end of November. A Category 4 storm is the second strongest level on a 5-step scale. Michael Brennan, the director of National Hurricane Center, says a storm of that strength can be destructive.
When you get to Category 4 strength, you can see things like total roof damage, roofs lifted off of homes, exterior wall collapse, trees uprooted, significant damage and a complete destruction of power lines and other infrastructures.
In May, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted above normal Atlantic hurricane activity for 2024 due to warm ocean temperatures. Beryl comes a little over a week earlier than previous record holder Hurricane Dennis, which got to Category 4 on July 8, 2005. Hurricane warnings have been issued in Barbados, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and Grenadine Islands, Grenada and Tobago, with tropical storm watches elsewhere in the Caribbean, while dangerous swells are expected to hit Puerto Rico and Hispaniola.
That's Saikir Jasni of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.